Accession number 4550, reel 3.
General Breeden, reel 5. How hard did Wingate drive you in the night squads?
Well, I think, judging from later experience I've had in various parts of the world, I think he drove us pretty hard. Down in the area where we were operating, Ironhorod itself is below sea level. And anywhere below that, you get deeper and deeper into the Jordan Valley. And then from there, you go up the mountains. So, by and large, you can say it is very hot. And this was the main part of when we were running around, was in the summer. We would sometimes go out for, say, 3 days and nights, of which the night time was spent clambering in the darkness up and down hills. The daytime would be spent lying up somewhere where we couldn't be seen and nobody knew where we were, and then off we'd set at dark again. And this was all done on an absolute minimum of water. And Wingate, I got the impression sometimes Wingate couldn't understand why we needed to eat every now and then. But you see, the object very often of his tactics was that he wanted us to reach a village which was probably 2 days' march away across the hills. And he didn't want the Arabs to have any idea that this was possible for us. So that's why we'd do the first half of it in the first night, lie up in the day, and then do the second half in the second night. The Arabs would be watching Ironhorod and the other two settlements where they eventually knew that the special night squads were, and would reckon that it wouldn't be possible for us to get to that village in one night. And by this method, we did it. We had our other ruses, which were going out in trucks and then dropping off at night along the road while the Arabs who were listening in the nearby hills would think that we'd gone on in the lorries, but we hadn't. We got out and we formed up and we went off somewhere else. But by the end of 3 days, on short water rations and very little food and being baked by day and stumbling over rocks by night, we were pretty tired, and we needed our rest when we got home.
How did Wingate treat you and the other squad leaders?
Oh, very, very correctly. That's a rather difficult word to describe. He was friendly but detached. You didn't visualize that one would have a sort of tremendous party with him. Just occasionally he relaxed. I spent about 4 months living in the same fairly small room as him, and he was a tremendous talker, and he would elaborate his arguments very cleverly. He actually convinced me at one time that the future state of Israel should form part of the British Empire and indeed be used by the British Empire to keep the peace in the Middle East for us, which all seemed to make sense to me then. And maybe that might be the answer, I don't know. Undoubtedly had a hold over us because of his personality.
What did the other British officers outside the night squads think of your activities?
I think a lot of them were suspicious. I think people in our own battalions who heard from us on those rare occasions when we saw one of them, I think they were rather jealous. They'd have liked the same jobs themselves. But I think when you got a bit further afield, and I think that the quite a bit of the administration in the country, I don't think quite liked the rumours they heard. See, what it added up with them was that here were British soldiers aided by Jews being used against the Arabs, which seemed to go against the policies that the government in Palestine should be adopting. Then one other lot of people who were fairly critical was the Transjordan Frontier Force. Now, the Transjordan Frontier Force was a force made up of Arabs under British officers, and they, very naturally, were rather pro-Arab and couldn't understand or didn't believe that the Arabs were gun-running and doing sabotage and this, that, and the other. And, of course, then were highly suspicious when they heard that British troops were living rather clandestinely in Jewish settlements, making forays against the Arabs, aided by Jewish supernumerary police. And indeed, one of the officers who was then commanding, I think, a squadron of the Transjordan Frontier Force in our neighbourhood is now General Hackett, who I got on very well with, but I think that he was pretty suspicious of our activities. I don't know. I don't think I've ever asked him. But that was the general attitude. Nobody really quite knew what we were doing, and I think they probably thought that Wingate was slightly mad. And I'm sure you know of the story of that Wingate managed to get hold of General Wavell and got General Wavell to agree to Wingate carrying out these sort of activities. And I think a lot of people thought that why should this unknown captain and the gunners be allowed to carry out his own policies, which appear to be pro-Jewish, and therefore are likely to annoy the Arabs even more. That is the sort of general attitude.
You describe the element of suspicion in the attitude of the Transjordan Frontier Force to the activities of Wingate. Do you know what Wingate thought of the Transjordan Frontier Force?
I don't think he... here I'm talking a bit off the book. I'm trying to recall, but I think that he thought they were just an obstacle in the way of what he wanted. He thought that they were just a lot of stupid Arabs who were commanded by probably a lot of stupid British officers who didn't understand that the right thing was Zionism. I think it's as simple as that. When Wingate came up against somebody who didn't agree with him, he merely felt that this chap was stupid. Now this, I'm afraid, happens with a lot of brilliant men. They think that anybody who's got a different view to themselves must be stupid. It's only an even more brilliant man who understands that there may be a second viewpoint.
Can you say anything further about Wingate's relations with the Jewish agency?
Do you know, I never got in, and I think he's probably absolutely right, I never got involved in this. He used to push off quite a lot, and I knew he went to Haifa, and he got a flat in Haifa where his wife was living. You can say that at the time, I knew very little about it. From time to time, he'd bring a chap back to Ayn Harad who would either organize something for us or get us some more lorries. And later, I realized that these chaps actually came from the the Jewish agency. But I never realized that this was going on at the time. I mean, later, having read the various histories written by various people as to what Wingate was doing, I realize now that he was spending a lot of his time trying to convince the Jewish agency that he was genuine, that he really did want to help the Jews. And they, very naturally, for a long time, were, I think, suspicious of him, because they thought that he was a British plant who the British Secret Service were trying to get into their favour so that he could report on what they were doing. But I had no first-hand experience of that.
What did you think of the measures which were taken at the time to prevent the crossing of the frontier between Palestine and Syria?
Well, there were relatively few measures, you see, because the only measures which did any good would have been if we had constant patrols, particularly at night. Now, as far as I know, all that happened most of the time was that we had either Transjordan Frontier Force or police guards on the various bridges over the Jordan. Now, this, of course, didn't stop the terrorists at all. And it was this running of arms and men and munitions into Palestine across the Jordan which had first caught Wingate's attention and had caused him to go to Jerusalem and ask if he could be permitted to go and investigate this business. They said yes. He then went down and lived in a settlement, I think it was called Tiretz V, and used, because he had no British troops with him, just himself on his own, he used the local Jewish supernumerary police to come out with him and watch the fords over the Jordan, and it was then that he caught some of these Arabs running arms and things across the Jordan. Having, with the aid of the Jewish supernumerary police, shot some of these Arabs, he then brought back the evidence to Jerusalem and confronted them with it and said, "There you are, I thought this was happening. Here is evidence, weapons and so forth, which I have captured." I believe that when the authorities heard that he'd been using Jewish supernumerary police to help him, they were horrified, but they couldn't argue against the fact that this arms running was going on. So that was the time at which Wingate then sought an interview with Wavell. In fact, he didn't get an interview. They tried to stop him seeing Wavell, but he stopped Wavell's car and jumped in. And said to Wavell, "Sir, I want to go on with this, and I want to be given some British troops in order to investigate further this arms running, and indeed all the other sabotage. Can I do it?" And this was when he was then given permission to raise the special night squads, and they went from strength to strength.
What do you think to the effectiveness of the Tegut Wall?
Well, I don't think it was very effective. The idea was quite good, but almost every night, again, resulting from the fact that we didn't move at night, as far as most of the British troops went, they used to pull large sections of it down. And I believe the way they did it was to get several camels and attach ropes to the camels and then attach the other end of the rope to the barbed wire and simply pull whole sections of it down. And at some places they got lorries and then would drive the lorries over just to flatten the whole thing. But it was, I think they regarded it almost as a joke. Every night we mended it, and every day we mended it, and every night they flattened it again. There were so many places along that frontier where it could be done that, short of a tremendous lot of patrols along the frontier, it was relatively simple to do.
Did Wingate squads observe the Teggart Wall, or did they cross it?
No, we didn't really operate up in that area at all. One of the squads, I think, was sent once to a place called Hanita, which was the first kibbutz built up on the Lebanon border. But they didn't do any patrolling along the border. Their job was to find out where the gangs were a bit further south. So the short answer is that we never had anything really to do with Teggart's Wall. Our main thing was to stop the sabotage on the pipeline and stop the arms and munitions being run across the Jordan.
Are there any incidents that took place with the night squads which you can recount, General Breeden?
Yes. Well, I'll try and tell you one which wasn't so much typical as that it was a good vindication of Wingate's methods and his astonishing intelligence that he managed to get hold of. There was a small Arab village right out in the middle of the plain of Esdraelon, about 6 or 7 miles from the village of Afule. And this village, Wingate discovered, lay on the main terrorist routes from northern Palestine down into Samaria. And they apparently used to stop there and for a night or two and reorganize themselves in this particular village called Kirbit Lid. And he got a lot of information on this, apparently. And then the thing was brought to a head because a couple of Jewish farmers went out one day in their truck along a track towards Kirbit Lid. And the country there is absolutely flat for miles. It's a great wide flat plain. And when they got near this village, they were shot at. Now, they were lucky. The people obviously shot when they were too far away, and they missed. And so the Jews turned their lorry round and rushed back to Afule and reported that they'd been fired at. So Wingate then got even busier on his intelligence finding, and he discovered a date when he reckoned that there would be one of these gangs in the village. So we got hold of a Jewish lorry driven by a couple of the Jews, and in the back of it we put 7 or 8 of our British soldiers under a chap called Corporal Walsh with a Lewis gun. And the plan was that the rest of our squads would drive on the roads which go around the sort of periphery of the plain of Esdraelon, and drop off at various points of the compass, so that in the end we would all drop off from the vehicles and we would then march centrally towards this village of Kirbit Lid from 3 or 4 different directions, so that if we did the thing properly, when dawn arrived, each squad would be half a mile or so from the village and forming a kind of ring round it. Well, astonishing enough, this worked, because map reading is not usually the strong point of junior officers, but we really did quite well. And it was a terrible march, because at that particular time of the year it had rained, and the soil was absolutely like thick porridge, and I remember having tremendous lumps in my groins after this march from the effort of lifting up each foot with about half a hundredweight of mud on it and going across the plain like that. Anyway, The operation was then timed that as dawn started coming, this Jewish lorry, a sort of Trojan's horse, came out along the same route as the previous one had, which had been fired at, and stopped about a mile or half mile from the village. And the two farmers got out and wandered about as if they were looking for something. And sure enough, the gang started shooting at them. Now, the object of this exercise was to make the gang declare themselves, because, as I think I've mentioned before, the hardest thing was to bring these chaps to battle with the weapons in their hands. Anyway, as soon as the firing broke out, of course the six soldiers and their Lewis gun then jumped out of the back and replied. The Arabs in the village, the gang, realized that this was a trap of some sort, but thought, that's all right, all we do is to rush out the other end of the village. And they rushed out across the open plain, straight into the arms of, or anyway towards, partly my squad and partly somebody else's squad. And I think we got about 22 Arabs that day. And they were all armed, and one was on a horse, which showed that he was a sort of fairly senior leader. One or two got through the cordon, and in fact we pursued them, and we still got them. And I remember Wingate sort of jumping up and down with joy at this very successful operation. He had a radio. It was about one of the first times we'd ever had a radio, and he was in touch with Haifa, and he was sort of reporting, yes, we've got 10, no, we've got 15, and so forth. That is a very successful one. It showed that his method of teaching us silence, dropping off at night from trucks when people thought that the trucks had just gone straight on, and a bit of subterfuge with this lorry containing the section of soldiers, all these things paid off, and that was one of our more successful operations. You see, what people don't realize is that in this sort of operation, you probably go out 10 or 12 times and see absolutely nothing. And then it's when you're getting bored or when you're off guard, then something happens. So you've got to keep on the top line all the time.
You went back to Palestine in the 47 period after the war, General Breeden. Is there anything you'd like to say in the way of comparing those times with the work against the Arabs in the late 30s?
Well, yes, I think I could, because, you see, it, what you might call, restored the balance. Perhaps at the end of my time there in 1939, I was pretty pro-Jew, having fought with them and up to a point for them, and the before 1939, we were being shot at by the Arabs. Well, now, when I went back in 1946, we were being shot at by the Jews, which was a completely sort of it was going round 180 degrees the other way. And furthermore, these were, by and large, Jews who we had trained. They'd been either in the Jewish Brigade in Italy, or they were members of the Palmach, or the Stern Gang, or whatever. But by and large, many of them were people that we, the British, had taught. And it was, in a way, a much more unpleasant experience, because they were much more efficient. A relatively few Jewish terrorists were able to lock up much larger numbers of British forces, and also, of course, the power of propaganda was against us. In 1938, the world had been interested, but not unduly interested, in the misfortunes of the Arabs, although the Germans had used it very much as capital. But now the Jews were shooting at us because they reckoned that we were too much on the Arab side and we were stopping illegal immigration and all that sort of thing. The methods they adopted, of course, made us very often very angry, because they staged very lethal little ambushes. They caught, as far as I remember, two sergeants and flogged them. It's the only time that I've really ever seen British soldiers really angry about the enemy. They didn't really get angry about the Germans during the war, but they did get very angry with the Jews in 1946. They felt, here are these people who we have rescued from the Nazis, who we've to a great extent engineered a place for them to live in as long as they behave themselves, and here they are treating us as if we were the Nazis. And the British soldiers were, as I say, I have never seen them regard the opposition with the same dislike as they did of the Jews at that time. Of course, I mean people like Mr. Begin, who is now the Prime Minister of Israel. He was one of the leading terrorists at that time. But I, in fact, went back to Ayn Harad during that period, and I was very kindly received. Everybody was pretty secretive, very naturally, but they must have made an exception in my case. But on the propaganda side, you see, whereas not many people, except perhaps Germany, took up the cause of the Arabs and used it for their own propaganda before the war, in 1946 and 47, you had only got to make a long nose at a Jew, and the whole American press went up in smoke. And you were accused of anti-Semitism and this, that, and the other if you breathed one word against the Jews, in spite of the fact that they were shooting at you. So all those things added up. I think I can say that I've seen it from both sides, being shot at from each one at different times. But my final opinion really came down to the fact that I reckon that that the Jews deserved a state of their own in Palestine. They were much more hardworking, cleverer, scientific, and all that sort of thing than the Arabs, and that therefore they deserved a state of their own. But, and it's quite a big but, that if only they could find it within themselves to be more magnanimous to the Arab refugee problem which has been created by their state, then I would almost back the Jews wholeheartedly.
In this later period, after the Second World War, that you returned to operate against the Jewish gangs, did you ever feel that there was any suspicion of you on the part of your commanding officers, senior officers in the British Army, towards you as someone who'd commanded one of the night squads before the war, when you'd been working closely with the Jews?
Well, no, I don't think so. Indeed, in some ways, I was able to sort of tell them the way that they worked. At that time, after the war, I was a lieutenant colonel I was the chief administrative officer of the 6th Airborne Division in Palestine, and as such, wearing a red beret and all that sort of thing. And no, I don't think there was any suspicion. In fact, I mean, my divisional commander, who was General Castles, who became CGS later, he was quite glad, in a way, to have a bit of insight into the way that the Jews did things. I may say that the Jews used to call the 6th Airborne Division the little red poppies with the black hearts. That's what we were supposed to be, simply because we wore red berets, but we merely carried out our jobs. It's exactly the same principle on which the IRA probably have various names for British units in Northern Ireland.
Why black hearts?
Well, because they thought that we were hard-hearted. You see, we didn't have any, we didn't make any allowances for things. But after all, we were only trying to be fair and treat them exactly the same as we treated the Arabs when they made trouble. And this was, I say, I'm afraid I blame the Americans a very great deal for that, because the Americans were so pro-Jew that they couldn't get the idea of fairness, that if somebody shoots at you, you've got to deal with them exactly the same way as you would deal with somebody else who shoots at you.